Welcome to our Leadership Intelligence podcast series. My name is Charles Rogel, and I'm the Vice President of Products and Marketing for DecisionWise. Today I'm talking with author Liz Wiseman regarding the release of the revised and updated version of her book, Multipliers. Hi, Liz, and welcome.
Good to be here.
Liz Wiseman teaches leadership to executives around the world. She's the president of the Wiseman Group, a leadership research and development firm headquartered in Silicon Valley, California. Some of her recent clients include Apple, Disney, Facebook, Google, Microsoft, Nike, and many others. Liz has been listed on the Biennial Thinkers 50 ranking for 2013 and 2015, and she was named as one of the top 10 leadership thinkers in the world. She's the author of three best-selling books. One is Rookie Smarts, then Multipliers, and The Multiplier Effect. Today we'll be talking about the release of the revised and updated version of Multipliers. So Liz, tell us a little bit about Multipliers for those who haven't read it before.
So Multipliers for newcomers to this topic.
Right.
The idea, you know, in some ways it's about, you know, you've read these books like Leadership for Dummies.
Mm-hmm.
In some ways, it's leadership for smarties. And and really, it's about two different kinds of leaders, one that I call a diminisher and one that I call a multiplier. And the reason why I say it's like leadership for smarties, because what I noticed, and this came out of my work experience before I began researching this, was this observation that sometimes the smartest people don't end up creating the smartest organizations.
Yeah.
Meaning they're really smart, maybe even a genius, but somehow people around them don't get to be smart. That you know, like when they walk into a room, people kind of hold back, they quiet up, they offer only the safest ideas. Like somehow that leader is smart, but they're not causing smarts. That mm-hmm. they and their presence dumb down an organization. And I call them diminishers for the obvious reason that they tend to diminish the intellect, the know-how, and the capability of others. Now, it's not like people get dumb, at least not in the short term. It's that people don't get to use all of their intelligence at work. And what I found is that although people don't always get to use all their intelligence at work, they still bring it all to work. And it's actually painful for them to not use it. So there's that diminishing leader. And when I measured how much of people's intelligence they get access to, you know, based on people's reported use of their capability, these leaders got less than half of people's capability.
Wow.
So, yeah, you know, and of course they're paying full price, you know, they're paying a
right.
dollar, so to speak, for someone to come to work, and they're getting 50 cents of value on that dollar. So that's the diminisher leader. But I noticed a different kind of leader that I came to call a multiplier, and these are people who are also really smart and capable, but yet they use their intelligence in a way that other people are capable around them. In fact, even more capable, that when they come into a room, you know, people sit up, they contribute, they offer good ideas, their thinking gets sharper, you know, problems get solved. And you know, these leaders, I called them multipliers because they become the multiplier to the intelligence of the team. And
yeah.
I found that these leaders not only get all of people's capability, that people tend to grow around them. People say, yeah, I got smarter and more capable working for this person. So the book is an exploration of why is it that some leaders suck the
right.
oxygen out of the room and like dumb down their colleagues, where other leaders seem to unleash brilliance. And
well, that's
why is this?
Yeah, and I was going to say, it's interesting because I think we're all familiar with both types of leaders. You know, if you've worked long enough, you probably had one boss or the other. I'm wondering in your research if you've seen, I imagine there's kind of a spectrum or continuum of these types, but is there kind of a percentage of the multiplier versus the other types that are just kind of not, you know, the worst leaders in a way?
You know, so this is actually one of the reasons why I wrote the second edition, because when I was writing this first piece, it was also my first book, so I knew nothing, is I'm exploring what do these multipliers do and what do the diminishers do, and I was still seeing the world in kind of a two-dimensional framework, that there were either these multipliers and diminishers, and you're right, everyone has worked for one of these two kinds of leaders. And this idea really, really resonated with people. But it wasn't until, you know, in some ways the ink was dry on the book that I really came to understand that most of the diminishing that's happening in our workplaces, mm-hmm. you know, as well as in our community centers and churches and homes even, that most of the diminishing that's happening in our organizations isn't coming from the tyrannical, narcissistic bully.
Uh-huh.
That most is coming from what I call the accidental diminisher. You know, the well-intended leader that really values leadership. You know, these are people who read management books. These are people like me who write management books mm-hmm. that with the best intention are having a diminishing impact. And the more I've been out teaching and learning and listening and studying this, what I'm finding is that's where the biggest problem is. It's the well-intended leader.
Yeah, yeah. They might even be well-liked, but they still don't necessarily inspire their people to do more, make them a multiplier.
Right. In fact, they might be diminishing because they are well-liked, that they've created a safe environment, a people where people feel good, they like their boss likes them, but maybe they've stopped short of becoming a true like challenger, inviting
yeah.
people to do hard things, the kind of things that are uncomfortable and often unpopular. You know, right now, Susie Welch is just about to release a new list. She's doing a piece for LinkedIn, and I'm contributing to that. And she's looking at not just like what makes for a great place to work, mm-hmm. but what are the places that people actually want to work for? And sometimes the places that people want to work are more than just a great place to work. They're places that have a hard edge where,
yeah.
like, ooh, it doesn't, it's not necessarily comfortable here.
Yeah, it's like, challenging, stretches.
It's challenging and stretches, and we're doing amazing things. So I think I've come to realize in some ways that the bad guys, the diminishers, and many times they're the good guys. They're the people mm-hmm. who we think are doing a good job leading, but so much of it is still diminishing. So one of the things in this new edition is a whole dedicated chapter around this idea of the accidental diminisher. Now, it's referenced in the first book, but I decided we're just really going to dig into this to help the well-intended leader really find their flat spots and what might be going awry with the best of intentions.
Now, I think the interesting thing here is that the Multipliers was originally published back in 2010. So now you've had a good 7 years of experience of kind of really testing these ideas and working with organizations and speaking to, you know, a variety of different audiences. And so you've come back now with all this additional learning that's been put in the book. And so what we'll talk about today is there's basically been six updates to the book. The first one is in the preface, talking about how the landscape has changed in the world today. We've already kind of touched on, there's two new chapters. One is on how to deal with the diminishers, and the other one is this concept you just mentioned, these accidental diminishers. And then there's a new section on how to affect lasting cultural change inside organizations, so not just on you as a manager, but the whole organization. And finally, the last two, the set of tools to enable managers to put the ideas into action in the appendix, and then a number of new case studies throughout the book in general. So let's go through each of these, and the first is the preface. You know, how has the landscape changed a bit since the book came out?
Well, when the book came out, it happened to just come out at a time where we were just following the global economic crisis of 2008.
Yeah.
And managers around the world are scurrying because they're now in an environment where they have to do more with less. Most people have had their budget slashed. And so the idea of multipliers resonated with people primarily for the economic argument.
We got to boost productivity.
We got to boost productivity, and we have to get more, not with less. No one really likes that. I mean, that's a fun challenge for what, like a week or two. But how do I get more by getting more out of the people who already work here? And the beauty of this argument was it's not extracting things from people people don't want to give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I studied leadership, but you know what I tell you? You learn when you study leadership, you learn a lot about followership, and I have learned And I think this is like the very kind of work that DecisionWise does. What I've learned is that people come to work every day desperately wanting to contribute 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's painful for people to have to hold back. So leaders who need to get more from the people inside the company are actually offering a, it's not torture, it's not extraction, it's
right,
offering
right.
a chance for like, oh, really? You really want to know what I think? Like, you're really going to give me hard things? I love it. So that's, I think, where this idea hit a need 7 years ago. It was primarily economic, but I think the world has evolved a lot in 7 years. First of all, I think the jury has come back in and delivered a verdict on diminishing leaders and said, not okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think we were evolving to realize we need leaders who can do more than command and control and extract. We need leaders who unleash. And, you know, 7 years ago, this idea was perhaps subversive. One of the endorsements, this is my first book, and one of the endorsements comes back and says, this is a subversive book. And
really?
As a new author, I'm thinking, is that good or bad?
Because right.
That sounds bad, but I think it's good because I do think it's a subversive idea that we actually need leaders to be playing a different role. I think the jury's back in, and we've decided that this is the model of leadership we're going the distance with. I think what has changed is as millennials have entered the workforce, they expect this kind of leadership, and millennials have been, you know, I am not a millennial. I'm probably, you know, like at the very tail end of the boomer generation. So I am supposed to, like, by virtue of my generation, I'm supposed to hate millennials.
But right.
I really don't. They've been like an icebreaker. They've, you know, like these big icebreaker boats that go through and plow the frozen seas and clear the frozen seas. Millennials have done this for the whole workforce because what millennials want, engagement. I want a voice. I want a chance mm-hmm. to contribute. I want an impact. Like all these things that boomers supposedly resent.
Right.
I don't know a single person in senior leadership in that boomer generation that doesn't want those same things as well.
Yeah.
See, technology has just enabled and empowered millennials in a way to give voice to what everyone wants, which is engagement and a deeply fulfilling work experience.
Yeah, and I think for the other generations, they weren't expecting it right when they hit the workforce. They thought, oh, I got to pay my dues first before I can really have an impact. But nowadays, that's totally changed.
Well, it has changed, and it's one of the other reasons why I love what millennials have brought to this workforce is the sense that experience doesn't necessarily heighten your contribution in so many parts of the work we do today. That
mm-hmm.
that actually being new and naive and is actually an asset right now. And people can come into the workforce and contribute immediately if we just let go of some of those assumptions. So, you know, how has the leadership landscape changed? I think we're hearing that we need this kind of leadership, not just for economic reasons, but for to yield the kind of innovation we need and for purely coping reasons, because there's now too much information for any one person to know.
That's right.
Bosses can't be a know-it-all for very long before they are irrelevant and drag their team into irrelevance with them.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the new chapter, Chapter 8, and this is on how to deal with diminishers. And I imagine this is probably one of the most frequent questions you received as you went out speaking and training, and that is, how do you deal with a diminisher, you know, if your boss is the diminisher? So these ideas are all great. They're totally inspiring, but I've got to go back to work and now work for a boss who's a diminisher and is really, you know, killing my engagement or really making it difficult for me to implement a lot of these new ideas.
You know, Charles, it's funny that you use the word like, killing my engagement, because this is an issue that I've heard from so many people. It was the impetus to write this book, but the word kill, uh-huh. What I found is that people really didn't want me to come in and teach leadership to them and their organizations. What people really wanted from me is like an assassination service. Like, could you just I mean, no one ever asks it that directly, but they're pretty much like, could you just come kill my boss for
Right,
me?
right.
When the book first got released back in 2010, I kid you not, we got actually several emails to the website saying, you know, like, would you be willing to mail an anonymous copy of this book to my boss? And at first I thought this was what a clever idea. Like, we could have an anonymous service. Like, you send us the name of your diminishing boss and we'll like just surprise them with a book. And I was delighted by this for about, you know, 22 seconds before I realized what a terrible idea this was. But people were saying, okay, like, could you just get rid of this person and truly like just take them out somehow? And if you can, you know, we're like, well, basic morality and ethics would, you know, means we can't really do that.
Sure.
Or two, they're like, okay, well, if you can't get rid of them, could you just come coach my boss for me? Like, come, could you come wave your like pixie dust over my boss and turn them into a multiplier? Well, I wish I could, but I really can't, because, you know, there's this fundamental like law in the universe that says that we get to change ourselves, but we really don't get to change anybody else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know about you, but I have been wholly ineffective my whole life trying to change anyone else.
It's true.
Particularly when they're related to me or married to me.
Like,
if they're at roommate status, child status, like, you know, you really only get to change your response. So, yeah, you know, we've been out teaching and coaching, and we've seen profound shift, but that's only when somebody else chooses it and wills it and works for it. And so if you can't get rid of your diminishing boss and you can't poof them into the kind of boss you want, then you're left with how do I effectively deal with them? And, you know, there you face a choice as well. You can either subscribe to a set of tactics around, okay, how do I, you know, how do I deal with the bullies in the marketplace? I know there's a book coming out, like, you know, the asshole survival guide. Of just like, how do you deal with the rotten people around you? And it's a set of tactics for keeping them out and away. But what I found when I dug into this is most of the strategies we use for dealing with diminishing leaders don't work or actually exacerbate the problem.
Yeah.
Because the most common strategies are confront them, avoid them, quit, or, you know, just comply and lay low, which is essentially quitting and staying
right
in your job. But that these strategies are actually the very least effective. When I looked at all the strategies people were using, these were the least effective. But here's what does work. What does work is, rather than dealing with your diminisher, it's choosing to be the multiplier in the equation. Let me maybe explain what I mean by that. Let's imagine, for example, that I work for you and you are a micromanager. And in fact, let's kind of put you in sort of the diminisher camp. You're sort of controlling, you dictate, you micromanage, and you're micromanaging me.
Okay.
So you can just have fun with it for a second.
Okay.
Just embrace your role as the evil boss.
Okay.
Just a moment. And you're micromanaging me. What is my natural reaction when somebody is trying to control me and micromanage me and my work?
Usually at first I would sense there'd be some resistance or some, you know, some kind of either resistance or just, you know, acquiescence, that they just kind of accommodate, give in, and kind of do what you say.
And it's true. It's on the surface, people either acquiesce, but it hurts them inside, or they resist and they confront, and that doesn't tend to end well. That's,
yeah,
you know,
you lose.
you end up losing. At best, it's a Pyrrhic victory that,
yeah,
you gain. But inside, what's happening inside your head, it's almost always the same, is that people are assessing the behavior. Like, I'm thinking, oh man, Charles, like, he is a control freak. He's, you know, he's a diminisher. He's like, got this grip on me, and I am assessing and I am judging you, and I'm deeming you to be ineffective and wrong. And like, there's a whole set of judgments that people cast on that.
Yeah.
So if I'm criticizing and judging you, I tend to stop listening to you.
Mm-hmm. 'Cause then anything I say is discounted.
Yeah, because you're a bad boss. Mm-hmm. And so you're the source of my problems. You are a bad boss. I probably start criticizing you to others. I stop listening, and I exclude you. I'm like, and we tend to do this to micromanagers. We're like, how do I get you out of my business? Like,
right.
Out of my hair? How do I keep you at bay?
Right.
Well, what do you think is going to happen if I'm starting to push away a micromanager? I'm sort of a control freak of a micromanager. You're being excluded and pushed away and criticized. What are you naturally going to do?
Oh, I'm going to pursue even harder then.
Yeah, you're going to double down on the very diminishing behavior. Mm-hmm. And we see it happen over and over. Like, if I'm excluding you, you're going to ask to see the agenda in advance. You're going to want to review this because you're suspicious that there's something wrong. Like, mm-hmm. clearly Liz isn't doing her work that she doesn't want. Like, if she's doing a great job, she'd want to show it to me. She'd want to include me. And you know, so if you're being excluded, you're going to double down. And now we've got this standoff between two, not just one diminisher, but two diminishers, because I'm now doing the very same diminishing things. I've stopped
right.
listening. I've judged. I've criticized. I've kept you out.
I've turned you into me.
Yes, you have turned me into you, and we see it happen all the time. I think I might have a bit of a bird's eye view on this because I hear so many people tell me about their diminishers, and what I see is they are so twisted up about it that they haven't really recognized that they've become that they're operating with the same logic. Like, hey, my boss is an idiot. Mm-hmm. Like, they'll never figure out how to lead. Which is at the core of diminishing logic. Like, no one's going to figure it out without me and my intervention. And
so you get stuck in that spiral.
You get stuck in a spiral. And what I have seen that works, not changing the other person, but changing the dynamic,
mm-hmm.
is when the person responds, instead of with judgment, with curiosity, okay. which is the hallmark of the multiplier leader. I found that, you know, I looked at all these different traits of multiplier leader. The one that bubbles up to the top, the hallmark of multipliers, is that they have intellectual curiosity. Gee, you know, I wonder what my employees can teach me. I wonder what I can learn from my customers. I wonder what my boss can teach me. I wonder if there's something here I don't understand. Maybe I don't have all the information. Like, these are the kinds of questions that people who are intellectually curious ask.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're operating like a diminisher, I can respond with judgment and follow with diminishing, or I might choose to play the role of the multiplier. And I might ask, you know, I wonder why Charles needs to be involved in this. I wonder what he's concerned about. I wonder what he's worried about. I wonder mm-hmm. what pressures he's getting from above him in the organization. Gee, I wonder what he needs from me to feel confident that we're going to get this done, that this thing is getting across the finish line, that we're going to win. And if I start responding with curiosity, I'm now considering your perspective, I'm listening, I'm learning, I'm more likely to invite you in.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do in turn when you've been heard and validated and invited to the party rather than exclude?
Yeah, then I'm going to relax a little bit more and loosen up.
Yeah, it's what we find, that you're more likely, you'll feel trusted mm-hmm. and respected. And when people feel trusted and respected, we tend to respond with trust and respect. So now, by extending my boss a little bit of trust and respect and curiosity, I've just now earned trust and respect and curiosity, and most important, I've just earned some space.
Yeah.
And it doesn't turn the tyrannical micromanaging control freak into a multiplier. What it does is it changes the dynamic for us. Like, maybe at worst, it means that you're just going to go off and diminish somebody else.
Right. You're off the watch list.
Off, Exactly. I'm off the watch list, but someone else is getting scrutinized.
Well, I like how you phrase it in the book where you say, why would a reasonable person act this way, right? So you're giving them the benefit of the doubt that they are reasonable, that there's some reason that somebody would be a micromanager, that there's some kind of worry or deeper emotion going on there that's triggering this kind of a reaction that you seem to always get. And that as you phrase it that way, all of a sudden they're not so much the bad guy anymore. They have a reason for kind of acting the way they do, and you're able to respond in a better way.
Yeah. It really is the art of upward empathy,
mm-hmm.
of understanding where the boss is coming from. It's a little practice I use. I meet with a lot of executives, and one of the things I do is I usually just ask myself a few questions before I go into those meetings, really trying to understand what the world is like from their point of view.
Yeah.
Like, even sometimes I think, wow, I wonder what meeting they just came out of. Did they just lose a critical hire? Are they dealing with a shareholder lawsuit? Did they just get a phone call that said one of their steady, loyal customers is going to not buy from them this year to the tune of multi-million dollar contracts? Like, and it helps me by empathizing with them. I think it helps to be more influential because you can understand the world and help your ideas cross over into the world and what they care about.
Yeah, and I think this chapter was really beneficial because it's not easy. You know, at the end, you know, it's not going to be easy to kind of work with these people, but there are ways to make it better and to be more effective and hopefully turn them around to being more of a multiplier than a diminisher.
And I do think it reverses that cycle. I think this idea and putting this chapter together, dealing with diminishers, is the main reason why I said, you know, we're going to do a second edition now rather than wait till a 10-year anniversary, which is when the publisher was thinking we would do this second edition, is I just see a lot of pain out there. And my message through this work is that you can, diminishing is real. Like, I cannot deny the diminishing effect. I see too many people and too many organizations suffering under diminishing leaders to deny its reality. But although it's real, it isn't inevitable that you can break the cycle of diminishing. You can be a better leader than your boss. And you can provide leadership, particularly multiplier kind of leadership, from any vantage point in the organization.
That's a good point. And this this kind of leads to the next chapter, the new chapter, chapter 7, which is about accidental diminishers. And this was interesting because as I read through this, I was looking in the mirror and thought, oh, yeah, that's me. Oh, yeah, that's one that I do. And like you said earlier, as we were talking about this, you know, these are well-intentioned actions a lot of times or behaviors, but they come off as diminishing to people and they kind of suck the life out of people in certain aspects. And there's a fine line between being, you know, being a good leadership competency and then maybe taking it too far or, you know, just kind of being slightly off base where it leads to a diminisher type of response. So do you want to talk more about these accidental diminishers and kind of how people fall into these habits?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I probably should start with the caveat that having some of these accidental diminisher tendencies does not make you a diminisher.
Oh, phew.
It does not. So you're good. You're good for now. It does not mean that you are having a diminishing impact. What it means is, first of all, that you're human. But it means that you're vulnerable. Like, these are your vulnerabilities. These are the things to watch for. Essentially, like, if you're driving and there's blind spots, like, when you're changing lanes, those are the places you want to go to and double check. And maybe this idea of changing lanes might equate to when something is really important in the business, when is where your accidental diminishers tend to come out, like when you're changing lanes, when you're accelerating. For me, I know I am most likely to diminish my colleagues I really value, colleagues I kind of love, when I'm excited about something. Because when I get excited about something, like, I'm whooped up, like, lots of energy, and it tends to bring out some of my knacks. natural tendencies. So let me just name a few. You know, and for those listening, you might just be thinking, which of these might be your vulnerability? And maybe I should add a second caveat before I even get going here, is that it doesn't mean you're having a diminishing impact, but here's what I can almost promise you for sure, is that if you're having a diminishing impact, you are going to be the last one to know.
Huh.
So let me share a few of these.
Okay.
The idea guy. This is a person that loves creative environments. We're full of ideas. We ideate. We toss out ideas thinking that the people around us will then jump on those and it'll catalyze and spark other ideas. But Charles, maybe you can just play with me for this.
Sure.
What do you think actually happens around the idea guy?
I've been around some of these people, and they're great. They have lots of energy. They have some great ideas a lot of times, but it can be overwhelming because you're chasing rabbits sometimes. You know, every week it's kind of a new different thing. You know, some of these things don't even get finished, or the, you know, some of the new things that you're implementing don't get finished before you jump to the new thing, and so you never have a chance to really reap any of the benefits from what, you know, the work that you've sown. So it can be really, you know, I can see how it can be a diminishing type of effect because, you know, you can't really do everything that's being asked of you.
Yeah, exactly. And it ends up, it consumes so much of the organization energy in vibration rather than progress. So that's one. The other would be the always on leader. And this is the energetic, charismatic leader. This is the person who's got always something to say, always something to contribute. And they think, of course, that their energy is infectious. But maybe, Charles, I can ask you to just share your perspective on just this one scenario.
Okay.
Because I think it captures the effect of always on leaders. What do you do when one of these overly energetic, always on colleagues comes walking down the hallway towards your office?
Kind of hide in a corner some days. I mean, some days it's great. You could use a boost of energy and it's fun. Other times you're thinking, I'm just not feeling it right now and I don't have time to kind of sit and listen to this or go through this right now.
Yeah. These are, when people are in these always on mode, we tend to avoid these people. You know, like often we avert our eyes, like don't even make eye contact with them, you know, because you've activated them and now you can't get them to shut off. Or maybe the rescuer. This is the really well-intended leader. This is like the big-hearted leader who kind of loves up their people, doesn't like to see people suffer or make mistakes or fail. But what happens when a leader is helpful too early?
Yeah.
Too often.
Yeah, you don't have a chance to really see your idea through, to see if it was successful or not, to see if, you know, to see if you'd fail.
Yeah, you never get complete loop learning, do you?
No.
And it's funny because not only do people feel helpless, like, okay, I feel like a constant failure, you know, being rescued all the time. But actually, this is where performance problems tend to breed because, you know, let's say you're the boss and you're rescuing me. And in that rescue, you've like dotted the I's and crossed the T's in my work. Well, I just think I see nothing but success in some ways. Like, I'm like, hey, what's the problem with my work? It's always great. It's always perfect. And, you know, you may not see that the invisible hand of the rescuer has done that. And so you are talking to HR about, hey, Liz, this like sloppy employee whose, you know, work is full of mistakes. And I'm like, what? It all looks good for mine. Yeah. I've never seen it. Like, take a look at my work. It's great. You're like, I did that. So, you know, that's, and the rescuer is perhaps the leader that has the best intentions. It's also the number one way we see people diminish. Or let me pick another favorite, the pace setter. This is the person who's leading by example, setting the pace for high quality, low cost, innovation, customer service. Their notion is I will model the way. I will set I will set the pace for how big I want to go, how fast I want things done. I'll set the pace and other people will notice and they'll follow me. But what happens when a leader gets out ahead of their team?
I think they kind of sit by on the sidelines then. They see that, you know, it's too difficult to catch up, or you're not quite sure exactly, you know, what they're expecting from you, but you don't tend to contribute as much.
No, you don't. We find that when leaders set the pace, they're more likely to create spectators than followers. You know, when that gap is too big, we're so smart and we can calculate, like, I can't close that gap. I can't do what the superstar is doing or what my boss is doing. So I will just hold back because in some ways we don't like competing with our bosses.
Right.
That we just say, okay, let me just walk behind you a few steps. And people are watching the boss do her thing while everyone really wishes they could help and contribute. You know, it's great having superstars on your team. It's not so great when your boss is the superstar.
Yeah, that's for sure.
So, you know, there's a number of ways, you know, sometimes we can be, protect our people. Like, boy, I'm just going to shield them from the uglies of the organization. Like, I'll give them a little safe haven where they can work. And you know, we've stunted their growth, or we're perfectionists that are helping to iterate to get something just exactly perfect when we don't realize that, you know, maybe 90% done with 100% commitment is better than getting something perfect and killing people's commitment in the process.
Yeah.
Maybe we've become such like big visionaries that we don't leave room for other people to help put that puzzle together. So there's more that we can talk about, but I think the important thing isn't what are all the different ways, it's what's your way? Like, what's your vulnerability to just watch for as you're changing lanes? What's the blind spot?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you need to kind of manage or keep in mind as you lead people? So let's talk about the next topic, and that is, you know, the section on how to affect lasting cultural change inside corporations. So I imagine, you know, as the first edition came out, many leaders got excited about this, wanted to kind of have everyone kind of get on the same page and be a multiplier. But then they realized that, hey, we're actually changing the culture. There needs to be a bigger cultural shift that goes on here to really make this work. And so you've addressed that in this new version.
I have I'm really excited about this section because it has been, I think, the biggest barrier that people have found inside organizations, that individual will is not enough, that you have to build a culture where leading this way, using your capability to amplify and to bring out the capability of others, is a new normal. It's a norm. And so it does take thoughtful analysis of how do you build a culture. The other reason I'm really excited about this big section of the Becoming a Multiplier section is this is what I wish I could have put together on the first round, but I didn't know how. Like, I literally, it wasn't like I didn't know to do this. I knew this was a big issue, but when I sat down to really write it and to do this research, I'm like, how does a company do this across their culture? Well, I don't know, because it's a new idea and we really didn't have those proof points. So when I thought, well, where's my research points? Who's doing this well? They didn't exist. So 7 years later, they do exist. And we've seen companies try and fail. We've seen companies try and succeed. We've seen companies try, fail, and correct and get back on the path of shaping true culture. And you know, what my team and I have done here, and this one was really a team effort, was look at what are the elements of culture, mm-hmm. and then how do you go about affecting and shape the elements of culture.
Yeah, and I like the image that you used in the book, where you kind of look at the different layers that are where a culture is built upon, and how you kind of, you know, the recommendations you have for each one, basically.
Yeah. And the first, it was since I was having this conversation with John McNeil, who's the president at Tesla Motor Corporation, a company that, you know, it's just a phenomenal company doing such interesting things. And when I was talking with him about, he asked this question, how do we build a multiplier culture here at Tesla? You know, they, anyone who follows Tesla knows that they have this enormous growth opportunity and challenge ahead with the Model 3. This is make or break for the company, and they have to figure out how to produce a lot more cars, sell a lot more cars. And it's really changing the way they think. And the only way that they're going to be able to sustain this is if they have essentially, you know, sort of in this parlance, a multiplier culture. And he's like, how do I build this kind of culture? And John, like, just intuitively knew the first piece. He said, I suspect it starts with a shared language.
Yeah.
And it really is. When you, we took an anthropological view of culture that at its most surface level, a culture is created when people have a common language, a way to talk to each other, not just a vocabulary for communicating, but a way to convey shared norms and beliefs. But, you know, at the most surface level, it's a common language. Mm-hmm. And then a set of behaviors that we learn, like, oh, gee, if I behave this way, I fit in. And when I behave this way, I get booted out of the culture. And, you know, behavior replicated over, and like that cycle of success spins, it starts to generate a sense of shared beliefs, meaning when we behave this way, collectively, good things happen. We make rain, you know,
right.
We survive, we win. What are those winning beliefs inside of an organization? And in the process, we create heroes and legends that not only convey a set of shared beliefs amongst a group of people, that they become legendary, meaning it's passed on to the next layer. So if you're new to the company, you hear about these heroes and legends, these, you know, amazing multiplier-like leaders, and you say, man, I want to be like that when I grow up.
Mm-hmm.
And a culture replicates itself. It persists over time. And of course, there's a set of norms and rituals that help inculcate those beliefs. So we looked at these and said, how do you create a common language? How do you learn some of these behaviors? And, you know, the deeper you go, the more lasting of a culture you're going to build in your organization.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought it was really insightful because I know, you know, as a new leader, they're trying to figure out, how do I make this change? You know, I can do this within my department, but how do I roll this down to all the managers? And I thought the ideas there were really insightful. So anything else you wanted to say on the culture change piece?
You know, I think culture is a big topic. It's messy. In some ways, we can boil it down to answering the question, is that when someone takes a job at your organization or someone shows up to work on a given day, how do you want them to answer this question? What do I need to do to be successful here?
Hmm.
You know, we all come to work wanting to be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, and when they answer that question, are they answering it in terms of multiplier behaviors or diminisher behaviors? To be successful, am I supposed to have all the ideas and tell everyone what to do and micromanage so like we never make mistakes? Is that the story that gets told? Or is there a story about, you know, to be successful here, I need to use all the resources of my team. I need to not only use my intellect, but the capability of those around me. That those are the behaviors that will cause me and my team to be successful. But I think it comes down to answering that simple question.
Yeah, that's really key. So I know the next item here is really the set of tools that you've provided in the appendix section. So as I read through these, these were great. I mean, you had pages upon pages of different ideas and scenarios that managers could use in training and working with their teams. And, you know, as you kind of suggested, you're basically giving away a core part of the training that you've done here. And so do you want to touch on some of those exercises and why they're in the new version?
Well, I think they're in there because what we are friendly about, you know, the work that I do as an author, the work our company does through the Wiseman Group is, you know, we are mission driven, and we are trying, you know, we are not so secretly trying to rid the world of bad bosses.
Right.
And, you know, we're not only, you know, we're trying to build leaders that use the full complement of capability and develop the talent of people around them. That's what we're trying to do. And, you know, you got to build some good leaders in that process. You got to figure out how to help people shed the diminisher that I think lurks inside each one of us. And, you know, we do a number of things working with companies to do that. And we could either hold back some of what we know and offer that to the people who have the time, the money, the inclination to go, you know, to a training class or something, or we could give, you know, give that to everyone who wants to lead this way. And we've just decided that we want to put as many tools in the hands of readers and aspiring multipliers as we can. So we just took a lot of the good stuff that was in our training and put it out there in the book. And I hope somebody reads it and uses it. That's my hope.
Well, and I liked it because as I was reading through the book, there are many things that I thought, well, how do you practice that? How do you, you know, make yourself more of a multiplier in this way or that way? And those exercises really gave me some good ideas in terms of saying, oh, yeah, that is a great way to think about it and how to kind of, you know, model the right behaviors that you want for yourself as a leader and also within your team.
Yeah, and for each one of those little one-pagers on here's how to go do this, here's how to supersize someone's job, here's how to name the genius of, you know, each person on your team, here's how to ask good questions, here's how to offer challenge. In addition to a little, you know, bit of a guideline for how to go do that, there's also an example of a manager somewhere in the world who took that experiment and had some success with it. So mm-hmm. That was also fun, being able to profile a pharmacy manager, an auto sales manager, a tech leader who have all given a go at these things.
Yeah, and I really enjoyed that, the case studies, and that was kind of the last, one of the last points here we'll talk about is the number of new case studies that you put in here and outlining how someone got a hold of the book and they weren't quite sure of themselves at first, but they started implementing some of the things that they learned and really had some great success with it.
Yeah, this was maybe the hardest part of this new edition is because with, you know, when I wrote the book for the first time, you know, and Greg and I were doing all this work, we used almost every great example we had because it was new. But now that these ideas have been out there, there wasn't this dearth of examples. There was just this surfeit of examples. We had so many examples, and I poured through all of these, and I wanted to include everything.
Right. But,
you know, that was the hard part, was choosing. I'll tell you a couple of my favorite of these new examples. In the Accidental Diminisher chapter, there's an example from John Maxwell. So if his name sounds familiar to you, it might be, and particularly if you have studied leadership or read leadership books, I think John has written more leadership books than anyone on the planet, read by more people. He's an amazing leader. Uh-huh. And I had a chance to go down and do some work with his company and be part of the work he was doing. And when he heard about this idea of leaders multiplier, like, it instantly resonated with him. And I think it validated so many of his beliefs about what great leaders do. And when he heard the idea of diminishers, he's like, yeah, that's what bad leaders do. So he's like on board. And then we get to the idea of accidental diminisher.
Uh-huh.
And he has a little freak out because that resonates too with him. And he's seeing that some of his very best intentions as a leader might actually be causing a diminishing effect. And this incredible leader and learner says, I want to eradicate my accidental diminisher tendencies. Okay. He made it his personal development objective for the year. And he worked at it for a year. And he invited the people who run his company along with him to join him in this. And it's the story of this amazing leader, both a student and a teacher of leadership, who's saying, I want to quell the accidental diminisher in me that might be causing other people to hold back around me. I loved being able to tell his story.
That's amazing.
It was just amazing to me to see someone make this their number one objective for a year. and someone like John. And, you know, I love telling the story of Mike Felix at AT&T, who's this amazing leader as well, who said, I don't want to be an accidental diminisher, but he didn't. So he worked on himself to really fine tune his leadership, and he is an amazing leader. His starting point is
where do you go from there?
way above the rest of us. But he didn't just do it himself. He did it across a 7,000 person organization. This is the Midwest Internet and Entertainment Services Division for AT&T. And he introduced this language to his whole team, taught these behaviors, and mentored his team until this has become a norm and part of the culture across a 7,000 person organization. He wrestled down culture, and I think it's a really fine example for the rest of us.
Yeah, that's great. So let me kind of wrap up here, and then we'll talk, provide some final thoughts. So we've talked earlier about kind of the changing landscape that you talk about in the preface, and how millennials now expect a lot more and are actually energized more to kind of contribute, and how to be a multiplier and really achieve more with your workforce. The new chapter on how to deal with a diminisher boss is really important. And then the new chapter on what we just talked about, an accidental diminisher. Are there things that you do as a leader that are diminishers to your team? We talked about the section on how to affect lasting cultural change, you know, take this to a macro level. And then the tools in the back that are very practical and helpful for managers to use, you know, in everyday environment to really implement some of these changes. So Liz, any final thoughts as you're releasing the new edition here in the next couple of weeks?
You know, I'll share with you maybe two things that I've learned. And these thoughts maybe sprinkle throughout the whole book, but what I have learned in the last 7 years is it's not about whether you're a multiplier or a diminisher. Like, that is not a useful question. Like, gee, am I a multiplier or am I a diminisher? A more useful question is, what are the situations that tend to bring out my inner diminisher? And none of us are going to operate as a multiplier all the time, but this multiplier effect arises when our multiplier moments far outweigh our diminisher moments. So it's not like this ideal leadership model or this competency model that we have to wear all the time. It's like we can have our diminishing days.
Yeah.
How do you maximize how do you create as many multiplier moments around you as possible? That's where I would focus. And that's one big thing I've learned. I think the second big thing I've learned is I can boil so much of this down to two words. That what great leaders do is they create a safe environment. They create safety for others, not just emotional safety, but intellectual safety. But they don't just leave it at that. They don't just create a great place to work. They create an environment where people do great work. So they take that safety and then they use it to stretch, to ask people to do hard things, to offer a huge challenge, to ask the tough question, to hold high expectations. And if you can get those two dynamics working together, safety and stretch, people will give you their best thinking. They'll do their best work for you. And you'll build an environment where people are willing to go and tackle the tough stuff.
Excellent. Yeah, as you think about it, that is kind of the whole essence of the book distilled into those two concepts. And really some great words of wisdom to live by. So, Liz, I want to thank you very much for the presentation today, the conversation. And the book comes out, the new release is on May 16th, is that correct?
It is.
And so I think right now you can pre-order your copy on Amazon or any of the other booksellers. And so I want to encourage everyone to go out and get a copy, read the new chapters, learn from the new contents in the index. And Liz, again, thank you very much. Anything else that you'd like to share?
Well, I just want to thank you for not only reading it, for asking great questions, and for being willing to play with me on some of the back and forth. So thank you.
I'm glad to help.
I should have had you write the book, really.
No, thank you. It's been great. All right. Well, thank you very much. And listeners, hope to catch you again on a new new podcast series. And look forward to having you join us on our next podcast. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Liz.
Thank you.